Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, an investigation into how some sexual assault survivors were treated by the medical community has resulted in legislation on its way to the governor. We'll tell you what changes it would make. We'll also find out more about period shaming and how it creates stigma and even barriers to education. Also on the way, the state of Illinois has a new direct admission policy to simplify the college application process. We'll learn more about a way to pay for college that some say is similar to indentured servitude and why there's an effort to rein it in. Dust storms are dangerous along highways, and they seem to be happening more often. We'll have a report. And we visit with a group of mental health professionals providing emotional support to those suffering from anxiety and depression. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Illinois lawmakers have strengthened the state's longstanding sexual abuse survivors law in an effort to ensure patients receive critical care after sexual assault. The changes followed an APM Reports investigation last year that revealed for the first time how dozens of hospitals violated the law. Kate Martin has more details.
Cheryl Thompson was sexually assaulted last year and went to the hospital in Anna, Illinois. She wanted the doctor to collect DNA to prosecute the guy, but she says the doctor didn't believe she was assaulted and didn't offer an exam.
He told me if I wanted a forensic kit, no one in our area did them, and I would have to go 77 miles away to Mount Vernon to a place I didn't know, doctors I didn't know, and a city that I didn't know in order to get one done. Told me that nobody in our area did them.
Time is of the essence to preserve evidence after an assault. 8 days later, Thompson learned there were two hospitals within a 30-minute drive of where she lived. Nobody had mentioned them. She went to one as soon as she could, but...
by that time, the DNA was gone.
Without the DNA, there was little chance of prosecuting the man who raped her. Since then, Thompson shared her experience with journalists on social media and with lawmakers in Springfield.
Cheryl Thompson. Are you there, Ms. Thompson?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and... thank you for...
an existing law requires hospitals to either care for patients after a sexual assault or send them to a hospital that will. Thompson spoke in favor of a bill to strengthen that law. She says she was livid after her experience at the hospital, and she doesn't want anyone else to go through what she did.
I hope that each of you will take into consideration that the distance that victims are trying to be sent does more harm than good. Because most of us won't go that distance.
Our investigation last year showed some Illinois hospitals had violated that law hundreds of times, for example, by failing to offer rape kits. We also found some hospitals transferred patients like Thompson as far as 80 minutes away, even though a closer hospital could have treated them. The bill tries to address these issues.
Hi, Cheryl. Thanks for being with us.
I called Thompson just after lawmakers passed that bill. She hadn't heard the news.
No. Yeah, and let me interrupt you really quick. The Senate did pass it on the 31st, which was the very end of their legislative session, and now it's going to the governor for signing.
Oh, I can't even put it into words. I am just overwhelmed that it's going to be put into law. That, because of what I went through, you know, it kind of makes it worthwhile that something good is coming out of the horrific stuff that I had to go through so that someone else that comes behind me is not going to have to go through that same thing.
The bill allows the state to fine hospitals that fail to address violations. It also aims to reduce the long transfer times patients like Thompson face. Now the state must consider distance, wait times, and transportation before approving a plan. For the bill to pass, advocates and industry groups had to find common ground. It wasn't easy. Here's Cassie Yarborough, an assistant VP with the Illinois Health and Hospital Association.
At first, we all came to the table with our own ideas of how this should work, given realistic expectations or what's actually happening in hospital EDs or workforce challenges.
She and a colleague say hearing Thompson's story made it easier to find compromise. Representative Kelly Cassidy, a Democrat from Chicago, has pushed for these changes for more than a year.
right now, I think we have a pretty great law, and I'm not done making it better.
In an email, Governor J.B. Pritzker's office declined to say if he would sign the bill. I'm Kate Martin.
Every day, hundreds of millions of people around the world are on their period. The World Bank estimates 500,000 of them lack access to needed products. We look next at period poverty, which also includes a lack of understanding, the stigma, and barriers it creates to education. In some classrooms, menstruation is the reason some girls never return. For Illinois Public Media, Nora Longhi takes us inside a school in Sierra Leone, where one group is trying to change that. This story is part of the Illinois Partnership for African Women's Health Narratives.
It's a hot day at Education for All, a school in Allentown. 13-year-old Khadija Mara starts her day off with chemistry. There are only 6 students in the class. Khadija sits in the front row, hunched over her desk, trying to focus as the heat thickens around her. The classroom, a patchwork of wooden poles and corrugated metal, offers little relief. There was a time Khadija thought she'd never sit in a classroom again.
When I started to see my period, I was 9 years old and I was in class 4. I feel a warm something.
She was on her way back home from school when she noticed she'd bled through her clothes.
The neighbors that were outside, everybody was shouting that I've stained my uniform. And there was a woman that said, "You are no more a child, you're an adult."
She says they laughed at her. And after that, she was too ashamed to go to school.
When I want to wear my uniform, the same woman that said that I'm no longer a baby, that I'm a adult, they mocked me and I went inside and took off my uniform. I was not coming to school.
Khadija was eventually able to return to school. But for many girls in Sierra Leone, the story ends differently. Dr. Yambo Fasalugu is a district medical officer with Sierra Leone's Ministry of Health. She says in low- and middle-income countries, lack of access to period products and social stigma can cause girls to miss out on school or even drop out.
About 20% of women and girls have dropped out of school due to period poverty.
Period products are expensive. The average household in Sierra Leone earns less than $50 a month. Fasaluku says period products there can cost $4 to $5 American a month. This is more than most families can afford, especially in households with multiple women.
Menstrual products is not going to be a priority because you want to eat, you want to make sure that you're healthy.
But Fasaluku says there are solutions. Small local organizations working directly with communities to break the stigma and provide pads. One of these groups is Umentalk. The name means woman talk in Creole. Umentalk sends people across the country to provide menstrual hygiene kits and reproductive health education to children. Mariatu Marlietta is Umentalk's education director. She's at Education for All, the same school Khadija attends. Sun spills into the classroom as Yetta teaches a room full of 11 to 13-year-old girls about ovulation, menstrual cycles, and how to use a reusable pad.
They feel the release. How many days the egg they don't have fallopian tube? 24 hours.
Dr. Fasaluku says groups like Umentalk are making real progress, but that progress is fragile. In recent history, civil war, an Ebola epidemic, and the COVID-19 pandemic have slowed momentum. She says that lasting change will take national support through funding, education, and legislation that makes menstrual health a public priority. But while Umentalk can't single-handedly solve period poverty in Sierra Leone, for girls like Khadija, these resources can change their lives. Khadija recently scored high on her secondary exams. She says her success stems from learning about her period.
It was horrible back then, but now it's really good. I'm reaching to my goals, but back then, I was having a stress on my period that was not focused. But now I'm focused.
She says she doesn't feel the same shame anymore either. Khadija dreams of being a nurse one day.
To help girls like me, to advise them and to teach them how to use the menstrual pads and for them not to be ashamed but to be proud when they're seeing their periods.
Fulfilling this dream could be a challenge. Cathedral will graduate soon from Education for All, and she's not sure if her family can pay for the next steps. I'm Norlongi, IPM News.
This story is part of the inaugural project for the Illinois Partnership for African Women's Health Narratives, involving journalism students from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and Fora Bay College in Freetown, Sierra Leone. Stigma, shame, and embarrassment tied to menstruation is common across cultures and international boundaries. The Illinois Public Media Student Newsroom reporters interviewed young women in the Midwest about their experiences with menstrual shaming.
When I first got my period, I was in the fourth grade, and there was just one instance. It was maybe like my fourth or fifth time getting my period. I was sitting in my English class, and I was in a lot of pain. I would get cramps that would shoot up to my spine. And as a 10-year-old trying to focus and having those types of pain, you get super overwhelmed. And so I started to cry. And I remember my teacher at the time, he came up to me and asked me why I was crying. And I said it was my time of the month and I was in a lot of pain. And he said, well, women every day deal with that. They're able to do everything and function as a normal human being, so you should too. So I kind of sat there and I like cried and he yelled at me because I wouldn't stop crying. And then he made me get up and go to this desk that was in the corner, isolated by itself, and told me to sit there and think about my actions because I was causing a scene for no reason and it was unnecessary. But yeah, that was like the first time that I really felt ashamed to have my period and also like afraid.
My relatives were driving me up to an internship I had over the summer. We were almost there, but I was like, hey, like, guys, can we stop really quick? I have to go change my tampon before I get to this internship building. And my female relative just like turned her head towards me and she was like, don't talk about your period with your uncle in the car. He doesn't want to hear that. And I was just like, oh my God, you know. And I don't think my uncle really even cared. I think it made her more uncomfortable than it did my male relative. My female relative yelling at me for having a period or bringing up the fact that they exist, honestly, it made me more defiant. Like, now I will like go out of my way to bring it up, like, oh yeah, hey, like, I need to go change my tampon, I'm on my period, I'll be right back, guys.
I don't think it's something to be ashamed of. I don't want to feel something to be ashamed of, but I just kind of get rid of the feeling that sometimes I feel guilty or shame. Growing up, they give the period a lot of nicknames. Like your relative is here, your auntie is here. They don't call it properly. That sort of impression passed down to me from older, more traditional, more conservative generation. And although I rationally know this is not something I should be ashamed of, I still felt a lot of conflict internally. For example, I have a partner right now. There are times when I'm at home and I might need him to help me get products. I feel guilty for asking him, and I'm getting emotional over this, but it's like a very conflict feelings to know it's not something I should be ashamed of, but at the same time, like, having the feeling that this is not a very bright thing to be talking about.
I think the first time I had my period, I remember I was home and I went to the bathroom and then I realized it was happening. I just remember this like weight hanging over me and like feeling embarrassed when my dad found out. And I just started crying because I was really overwhelmed. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is going to be the rest of my life.
The first day I got my period, it was actually a really good day. I just spent all day at my grandma's pool with four of my good friends. We just spent a long day swimming. And then I went up to go change in the bathroom. And first thing I saw was a bunch of blood. I was super scared. I didn't know if something was wrong with me. I didn't know if I was hurt, or I didn't want other people to view me as not a kid anymore, as like, oh, this makes you a woman, when I was still just a 12-year-old girl. I just was scared to feel judged.
Carrying a pad or a tampon like out in public, the most shameful thing that you can possibly do. Like, you cannot carry a pad or a tampon in your hand. You gotta hide that in your shirt if you don't have pockets, which how many girls' clothes have pockets. So like, you gotta find somewhere to put that when you're going to the bathroom, and you better not get caught. So yeah, there's a lot of like little details, I think, in being ashamed of your period.
Young Women in the Midwest, discussing menstrual shaming and giving their views. That piece produced by the Illinois Public Media Student Newsroom reporters. Well, we have a lot of disagreements these days, and politics seems to create more rifts. Dan Kinney tells us he supports an idea that he says can help heal America.
There is one thing Americans agree on. Over 80% of Americans agree that our nation is more divided than it has ever been in their lifetimes. There has always been division in America. Disagreement is part of democracy. The problem is how we communicate with this disagreement. More than one in three Americans have permanently broken off a key relationship due to politics. Often these breaks are with close family members. The current divide in America has become a social change challenge. Recently, I learned about the Dignity Index, a practical tool for people to monitor their words before they regret them. It was started in 2022 by Tim Shriver. It is a method of evaluating language. At one end of the spectrum shows contempt for others, and at the other end affirms their value as a person. At the top of the spectrum is a point where no matter what, I will still treat you with dignity. I even took the dignity pledge. As an American who knows and loves my country, I am convinced there is no America without democracy, no democracy without healthy debate, and no healthy debate without dignity. Therefore, I pledge to do more to treat others with dignity, not contempt. I encourage you to learn more and to take the pledge. Be part of the healing. Go to dignity.us. I'm Dan Kinney.
That segment comes to us from member station WNIJ. We have more ahead on Statewide. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Illinois lawmakers passed a bill this spring creating a direct admission program to simplify the college admission process. Peter Medlin spoke with Jose Garcia from the Illinois Board of Higher Education to find out more.
What is direct admission? Like, what literally, what would this new law do?
So direct admissions is a new and exciting program that will allow students to be, as the name of the program suggests, or the initiative, directly admitted into colleges and universities across the state. The only requirement for admission will be students' GPA. They will need to meet the GPA requirement that each institution sets.
Each institution gets to set their own standards for GPA, but they're only looking at GPA. They're not weighing other factors like test scores or anything else.
That's right. Each institution, each public university will set their GPA requirement. Students will not need to provide any essays, no letters of recommendation, and application fees will also be waived. So in other words, this is a free program.
And the state does have a direct admissions program now through Common App. Can you talk a little bit about what the difference is between what we have now and what this new law would do?
Right now, students have to take the initiative and open a Common App account and profile and include their GPA. What the bill does and how the program will transform is students will not need to take the initiative. Instead, it will be us. We will have the student's GPA by students opting in, and then they will receive notifications without them having to apply that they have been directly admitted to the universities at which, you know, they meet the GPA requirement.
And again, this is for high schoolers and also community college students looking to transfer to a four-year school as well.
Right. So if you are a community college student who has completed 30 hours and you are eligible to transfer to a public university, you will be able to do so through this program.
Is GPA, is it weighted the same, right? Like high school to high school, we're just looking at across the board, universities are, you know, setting a standard. This is what the standard is, no matter what high school.
Yes, for high school students, whatever GPA requirements the universities set will be the same. We understand that certain high schools weigh GPA differently. And so, you know, we will do the work on the back end to make sure that, you know, however the school weighs the GPA correlates with the GPA requirement that the university sets.
This direct admission program includes all of the state's public universities and community colleges, except for two, the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and the University of Illinois at Chicago. Why not those two?
So the University of Illinois at Chicago and the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign will reach out through a campaign to students who meet certain criteria to encourage them to apply.
Is there a specific point on the calendar when students would find out exactly how many and which universities and colleges they were directly admitted to?
There's no set date for when all students will find out that they've been directly admitted. Students will find out throughout the course of the year. Now, I should clarify that for the high school class of 2026, which are the rising seniors, those students must create a Common App account and profile and enter biographical information and GPA to participate in the program. The high school class of 2027, which are rising juniors beginning this school year, they will be able to opt in to the program, and that will allow the GPA to be shared on the back end with us so that we're able to do the matches with, you know, with their universities that they're eligible for direct admission.
That's Jose Garcia with the Illinois Board of Higher Ed. He spoke with Peter Medlin about the state's new direct admissions initiative to make the college application process less daunting. Lawmakers are trying to rein in a new way to pay for college and training programs. They're called income share agreements, or ISAs. A student gets tuition paid in exchange for a cut of their future income. Supporters say they can be a good alternative to high-interest private loans, but critics liken them to indentured servitude. Lisa Curry and Phillip reports.
Jose Aguilar meets me outside a Starbucks after working an 8-hour shift. He's a delivery driver for FedEx. He was about to start his sophomore year at the University of Illinois Chicago when he found out he couldn't get federal financial aid.
That year, my father didn't file his taxes, and he was kind of like MIA on me.
Aguilar paid out of pocket for one semester, exhausted his life savings, then took a semester off and worked. He said he would have dropped out then, if not for Better Future Forward, a nonprofit that offered him a kind of private student loan he didn't know existed. Instead of repaying the amount he borrowed plus a really high interest rate, he'll pay a set percentage of his income for 10 years. And only when he starts earning $48,000 a year or more.
At least I know that if I lose my job, they're not going to charge me anything. And I'm going to be able to at least, like, sustain my own, you know, well-being. You know, being able to put food on the table, being able to pay for gas and things like that.
On the flip side, if he gets a really good paying job, he could wind up paying way more than he borrowed. Kevin James is the CEO of Better Future Forward, the nonprofit that helped Aguilar.
Your payments are calculated as a percentage of your income because we're trying to ensure that they are affordable. And you finish the obligation when you've either made 10 years of actual payments when earning above that amount, or if you have persistently low income, the obligation just ends after 20 years.
It's an option that could become more appealing as President Donald Trump and conservative lawmakers try to cut back access to federal student loans and grants. And families are forced to turn more to private lenders to pay for school. But not all ISAs work like the ones offered by Better Future Forward. Winston Berkman Breen is the legal director for the Student Borrower Protection Center, which advocates for more equitable student debt policies.
The majority of ISAs have been aligned with pretty shady for-profit, like tech boot camp center programs. And so if you want to even take the position that ISAs are tools and are not good or bad, they have mostly been used for bad.
That's exactly how Princeton Whittington got ensnared in one. The Chicagoan saw an ad for a 12-week training on user experience design. Reps from the company promised an $80,000 job upon completion. But Whittington either had to drop $13,000 for tuition up front or sign an ISA. and they were pressured into making a quick decision.
At the time, their new cohort was starting, and they was just like, yeah, if you don't pay up front or do this income share agreement, you can't start. Like, we'll just have to wait. And I'm just like, I can't wait because I don't have a job and I need some income. I should have hesitated a little bit longer.
The $80,000 a year job never materialized, not even close. Instead, Whittington has been cobbling together contract work. They have long stretches of unemployment. But as long as they're earning at least $40,000 a year, they have to send 10% of their gross income each month to a lender. They could wind up paying 60% more than the program actually cost. Whittington says instead of making education more accessible, ISA providers
find more ways to put you in debt so we can get more money from your debt.
Illinois lawmakers approved a bill last month outlining a long list of rules specific to ISAs, including limits on the number of payments and share of income a student can be charged. Students can't be made to pay if they're making less than $47,000 a year. Still, Whittington says students should find another way.
There are options out there. You just got to look a little harder.
Whittington is now considering enrolling in a tuition-free program at UIC once they've read through all the fine print. Lisa Corian Phillip, WBEZ News.
Western Illinois University's leadership says that institution is turning the corner, but they acknowledge more work remains. Here's an update from Rich Egger.
Western's Board of Trustees named Christy Mindrup to serve as interim president beginning in April of last year. The board removed interim from her title last December. Board Chairperson Karen Stutz says during the past year plus, Mindrup's administrative team has implemented a long overdue focus on improving Western's financial health. Stutz says the work done by them has brought Western closer to being a financially stable university that serves students, faculty, staff, and the region.
We feel very confident in today's leaders. They had a very short runway to make tough decisions with no time to spare. Good leaders do that. And Dr. Mindrup has demonstrated that she's had the courage to finally do something.
Those decisions have included layoffs and furloughs in the past year. Stutz says now that Western is moving out of crisis management, the administration must strive to develop a long-term strategy. She says while there's still work to do, the university is headed in the right direction. She's confident that Western will emerge as a stronger institution. Mindrup agrees that work remains.
The coming year will move WIU toward increasingly stable foundation taking shape as a result of financial adjustments, staff stabilization, and strategic planning.
Mindrup says the administration took a conservative approach to planning for next fiscal year, and that proved to be the right thing to do because the new state budget provides just a 1% funding increase for public universities instead of the anticipated 3%.
While we are grateful to legislators for any increase during tight budgetary times, we will continue to advocate at the state level for the equitable funding formula with our institutional allies and stakeholder groups.
Lawmakers did not act on the funding formula, which would prioritize schools that are currently the most underfunded, such as Western. Mindrup says while the administration continues to be fiscally conservative, they're also committed to growth and investment in academic programs that align with student interests and state and workforce priorities. But English professor Everett Hamner told the board that does not seem to be the case at Western's campus in the Quad Cities, where he worked. He says with staff sizes continually shrinking, he's concerned about the direction the Quad Cities campus is headed.
To be clear, I am not speaking only of the last year's budgetary cuts, but of a decade now of systematic starvation.
He would like to see the Quad Cities campus grow and succeed and says work has been put into imagining how that might happen.
But at some point, as far as this campus goes and as far as Western goes, we're going to need the hard choices, not just of painful cuts, but the hard choices of bold, warranted risks.
He says Western has invested in the Quad Cities for decades and should have an advantage in attracting students from the region. Hamner won't be among those teaching in the Quad Cities next school year. He's being transferred to the Macomb campus. Hamner said the administration is doing the best it can with limited resources, and he also expressed disappointment with the state's 1% funding increase for public higher education. Trustee Kirk Dillard also expressed frustration with that.
That number is just, it's mind-boggling how little priority higher education is for the state of Illinois. And it just, as somebody, you know, who obviously went to a public or attended a public university, but that 1% number is just, to me, it's just unconscionable.
He says it's unacceptable to give higher education a funding increase of just 1% in what is the largest budget in state history. Rich Egger reporting.
Part of the solution to climate change is sequestering carbon. And billions of dollars are being spent on carbon capture technology, but the Earth already has many natural sequestration processes, and scientists are exploring how they can be part of the solution. One of those is peat bogs, as Jess Savage with the Ag and Water Desk and Harvest Public Media reports.
It's Winterfest at Bolo Bog Natural Area in northern Illinois. Just outside the warm barn, filled with the sounds of live music, naturalist and educator Mary Caldwell is guiding brave souls on a frozen nature walk. She crouches down and reaches out towards one of the featured species on this tour, sphagnum moss.
I invite you to just touch some of the sphagnum. Just real gently, because it's kind of frozen-ish.
It's wet and cold and feels almost like running your fingers over a fluffy rug.
Okay, so you get an idea of it, but then in warmer weather, this is so soft. It's unreal.
Bog ecosystems are some of the most efficient carbon storage ecosystems in the world. They cover just 3% of the Earth's surface, yet hold up to 30% of global carbon. The bog's keystone species, sphagnum moss, plays a key role in its storage capacity. Sphagnum acts like a sponge. It holds up to 20 times its weight in water.
Sphagnum moss itself is incredible. It's very slow growing. It takes its time.
But bog ecosystems have been disappearing for decades. In Illinois alone, more than 90% of historic wetlands have been lost. There's about 110 million acres in the U.S., more than half are in Alaska, but nearly 70% have been drained and developed over the past 100 years. Wetlands provide habitat, filter water, and store carbon.
They're like no other ecosystem on Earth.
Dr. Tricia Atwood is an associate professor and ecosystem ecologist at Utah State University.
When we think about a forest or how much carbon is being stored in a forest system, wetlands can store carbon about 30 to 50 times faster at a higher rate than those other systems.
Sphagnum moss holds lessons. Scientists know it's a key to sequestration, but there's a lot they don't know. Sona Pandey is the principal researcher at the Danforth Plant Science Center outside of St. Louis.
The first time I saw a peat moss under the microscope, I just literally fell in love with it. It's beautiful to look at.
Moss excels at storing carbon. It thrives in waterlogged, acidic conditions. It doesn't decompose, acting almost like a giant mat of living carbon. But when they're threatened, that carbon has to go somewhere.
It is a possibility that all the carbon which is stored in peat bogs at the moment will be released to the atmosphere.
Pandey's research team is growing moss in a lab, studying its DNA, and trying to figure out how it is threatened by climate change, and also how it could be a solution. She says if we understand these mosses on a microscopic level, we can better protect and restore them on a larger scale.
We make very informed decisions about which species to introduce or which type of restoration efforts are needed.
Ecologist Atwood says bogs have been historically passed over, but they're getting a little more respect.
There has been substantial changes in people's perception of these wetlands just because they don't typically hit people's top 10 most beautiful places. Governments are starting to realize that they have these other benefits.
But a 2023 Supreme Court ruling imperiled even more wetlands. Rebecca Hammer is an attorney at the Natural Resources Defense Council, an advocacy group. Hammer says that the Sackett versus the Environmental Protection Agency decision, which rolled back wetlands protections, hits bogs the hardest.
Unlike some other types of ecosystems that we can, you know, artificially restore or create man-made versions of them, we really can't replicate peat bogs. They take thousands of years to form. So once they're gone, they're gone.
It can be easy to think of ecological issues and solutions as far from home. But Volo educators Caldwell says that they're often closer than we think.
So when we think about the natural world around us, sometimes we look at it like we're standing outside this big circle or this big web of life. But oh no, we are right in the middle of it all.
In Volo Bog, Illinois, I'm Jess Savage.
We'll talk about dust storms. That's ahead on Statewide. Stay right here. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Dust storms have been increasing in frequency in central Illinois in the past few years, but it's unclear whether climate change, farming practices, or something else is driving it. Ben Howell has more.
May 16th was a day of surprising weather. The Friday was warm, a high of 84 and partly cloudy conditions, a fairly normal day, until a dust storm blew its way from Bloomington to Chicago. Dust storms have been increasing in recent years, although they are not usually as large as the one on May 16th. Illinois State climatologist Trent Ford says just because we don't understand the weather around us doesn't automatically mean it is climate change.
And I think it's prudent to evaluate, you know, the role of climate change in all of our weather hazards to know what's going to happen or what is happening and how to prepare for it. But I think it's also important to say, okay, this isn't necessarily a climate change signal.
The two major ingredients for a dust storm are wind and dry soil. Ford says data suggests the state is actually getting wetter springs and wind is holding steady. Ford says the difficulty for him and other experts lies in predicting the storms. They know how and why a dust storm occurs, but not when one will happen.
What was the difference, essentially, between what happened a couple Fridays ago when we had the big dust storm and the day before, where we were equally as dry and equally as windy, but we didn't get the dust storm?
Ford says the ideal reason for predicting dust storms would be to better warn the public about the conditions. Meanwhile, farmers have been encouraged to do their part to better protect their soil and keep it from leaving the fields. One possible solution is cover crops planted during the off-season that enhance soil nutrients and hold it together. Nick Frillman is a local food systems and small farms educator out of the University of Illinois Extension in McLean County. Frillman says about 7% of corn and 17% of soybean fields use cover crops between fall harvest and spring planting. He says some farmers resist.
There is a non-zero cost for cover cropping. You're looking at cost of seed, and then we're looking at cost of fuel to drive the planter across the field, and then we're looking at the farmer's time, none of which come in high supply these days, right?
Farmers who use cover crops look to future harvest sizes and the environment. They hope for a return on their investment. Frillman says the story is similar for no-till farming. They sow seeds directly into residue of the previous crop and leave topsoil undisturbed.
If we leave that residue on the surface, there's an overwhelming body of research that shows that there is increased organic matter in the topsoil compared to tillage-based planting systems where there's less organic matter in that top fraction of the soil profile.
No-till farming also supports weed suppression. Surface residue prevents weed growth beneath it. Another possible solution to helping protect farmland and reduce the risk of dust storms is enforcement. Robert Hirschfeld is water director at the Prairie Rivers Network. He says practices like cover crops and no-tillage should be more than voluntary.
Other industries, other major industries in America, we regulate. We pass laws, create rules that require them to clean up their pollution or to limit the amount of pollution they're putting in the water or the air. We simply haven't done that for agriculture.
Hirschfeld says farming on erodible land leads to water runoff and chemicals leaving farmland and entering water sources. He says it makes sense dust storms have increased.
It's remarkable that we have turned a state that was prairie into a state where you can have dust bowls, but it's also the logical consequence of farming in this way.
Mike Kelly farms roughly 4,000 acres near Lexington. He started farming in 1988 and almost immediately started using no-till and cover crops. Kelly says he knows they help reduce dust storms, especially as he watched the soil on his land remain still on May 16th.
I think it'd be hard to argue that really no-till, strip-till, and especially cover crops, I think it'd be hard to argue that they don't significantly reduce wind erosion.
Dave Stutzman also farms out of Lexington. His recollection of the May 16th storm was similar but overshadowed. His mind wandered to public reaction to his profession.
Every time something like that happens, it is somewhat sad just because you know that people are going to think that it's all farmers' fault.
Stutzman says no farmer he knows is trying to destroy their soil. He says they want to keep their land for generations to come. I'm Ben Howell.
Black pediatric patients believed to have neurological conditions are falling through the cracks. Half of Black pediatric patients completed the necessary genetic testing for diagnosis and treatment. That puts them well behind white patients at 75%. It's just one disparity highlighted in a study from Washington University's School of Medicine. Neurology professor Dr. Christina Gurnett with the school in St. Louis said those tests are necessary to unlock treatment options. She helped co-author the study, and she spoke with Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson about the barriers Black families face accessing care with neurological conditions. She says several aspects of the study surprised her.
We were surprised overall that this really necessary genetic test, which opens up the possibility for treatments that can only be delivered if we know the genetic test result, we were really surprised that the completion rates were low across all children who we order these tests, but it was striking when we looked at racial differences.
What are some of the reasons behind disparities in genetic testing for neurological conditions in children, specifically Black children?
We first just looked at the process by which tests are ordered, and we know that a neurologist has to put in the order when the child comes to see us in clinic. And sometimes there's a process delay where the child has to come back either for another visit or to have the testing done. And in that time, the insurance also is queried to see whether it covers the testing. Looking at each of these processes, we could see that there was a breakdown. Some of it was in the insurance denials, which were much higher in Black patients. But that didn't explain all of the difference. We think there were other racial disparities in access to providers, other unmeasured problems with transportation and getting back to do the actual testing.
Why is this not seen as essential by insurance companies?
Well, the good news is that there's more and more research that's showing that it's very cost effective to do genetics. The gene test often will give a diagnosis where other much more expensive tests, including imaging studies or metabolic studies, have not been diagnostic of the condition. So I think as we prove that there's cost effectiveness of this, we'll be able to get more insurance companies to pay.
Now, when we're talking about genetic testing, does this also include the parents? Like, do they have to get the test as well?
For a lot of children that have severe neurologic problems, we really do like to test the parents as well. There's a new concept in understanding what causes developmental disabilities in children, and a lot of those are brand new variants that happen only in the child. And when we can look at the parent's DNA as well, we can clearly identify the new change that's the underlying cause for the child's disability because that change is only in their DNA.
You work with kids and their families. Before the study, what were they saying broadly to you about their real life experiences having to navigate this?
We know that families who have children, particularly those who have disabilities, are under enormous pressures, not only financially because they have problems holding down jobs when they have children that have complex medical needs, but the cost of the care, the cost of the therapies that they need also make it more challenging. So we're really willing to work with them in whatever way we can to try to make their lives easier. In this case, it means having another resource, another person that they can talk to who can help us get this genetic test for them.
What is Washington University School of Medicine's neurology clinic doing to address this problem locally?
So the good news about the research that we've done in our own clinics here at Washington University is that we recognize that there was a problem in getting the testing for a lot of children, but particularly for the Black population. We've been very proactive in using this information to advocate for more resources in our clinic. We now have a genetic counselor who can help us in identifying other avenues so that families may not need to pay out of pocket for deductibles that they can't. And there are workarounds that someone who's very embedded in the field can identify so that we can get testing for people whose insurance may not otherwise cover it.
Washington University Medicine Neurology Professor Dr. Christina Gurnett on a study that examined disparities in genetic testing among Black children. A group of certified mental health professionals has been making the rounds. They provide free emotional support to people of all ages and backgrounds dealing with anxiety, depression, and health crises. Jane Carlson has that story.
Boomer.
Homer is a friendly, 6-year-old jet black Newfoundland. Clint is a 4-year-old, 120-pound Chesapeake Bay Retriever, whose soft brown eyes almost exactly match his coat. Both are certified local therapy dogs.
Sometimes we get calls the day of, or within a couple of hours, we'll get a call from the hospital saying, hey, we've had an emergency or we have a crisis here. Can we get a dog in here?
That's Liz Pagel, owner and handler of 3 certified therapy dogs, including Boomer. She says the Galesburg Therapy Dogs program is offered through OSF Healthcare.
In order to become a therapy dog that's certified and insured, you need to go through a reputable program. We go through Alliance of Therapy Dogs, and they have a requirement that you have to be certified through a medical facility.
Once certified, dogs that enjoy working in a hospital environment continue to go there. Like if a child is fearful about getting some blood work done, they can request a canine companion. The dogs provide services throughout OSF St. Mary Medical Center in Galesburg.
When we visit with people in the ER, you can see on the vitals machines, you can see that the body calms down immediately. The stress starts to leave the body. With small children, when they have tragedies, sometimes they can't articulate what they're feeling and what they're experiencing. And we have found that they'll draw pictures. They'll sit with the dogs and draw pictures of what they're working through and what they're sorting out.
Pagel says therapy dogs help care providers, too. She says nurses will get down on the floor with the dogs and say they feel their blood pressure lowering. Deb Jackson started the Galesburg Therapy Dogs program around 10 years ago with a pit bull named Georgia. Remember Clint? Jackson is his owner and handler, too. She says Clint just got back from a Yellow Ribbon event in Iowa for servicemen who were being deployed, and he was very well received by the soldiers and their families. She says what happens to humans when they interact with dogs is a chemical reaction.
The mother that's nursing her child releases an oxytocin. You release that same chemical when you're looking into the eyes of a dog. So it's been proven that there is a reaction when you're going through pet therapy.
And Galesburg's therapy dogs are busy. In addition to hospitals, they go to schools, nursing homes, colleges, and mental health fairs throughout the region and beyond. They've been out to Hill Correctional Center in Galesburg, and they sometimes go on end-of-life visits.
And we've been called in by the family and asked, can you put the dog next to the bed so that my family member can touch their head or can feel the fur? And it brings such a sense of relief to the families and, I'm sure, to the person, even though they can't always articulate that.
Part of the job for Pagel and Jackson is deciding which dogs are right for which situations. In addition to Boomer and Clint, there are a number of other certified therapy dogs in Galesburg. Pomeranians, Basset Hounds, Beagles, and more.
Georgia, the little pit bull, is perfectly happy upside down for 6 hours and not moving. Clint likes movement. And so you do have to kind of gauge, like, we just got back from reading at a grade school, and I would never have taken Clint because he wouldn't have done that. Georgia was upside down for the whole day being read to.
So Pagel and Jackson have a core group of people and their dogs who are reachable on short notice. When the request comes in, they send out a message and say, here's the need, and it's a pressing one. Who can get out there? And they're getting more and more requests. Recently, a local school reached out saying, we have a mental health crisis here. We're out of options, and we need help. Can you send some dogs? Just this spring, Galesburg Therapy Dogs have been to Knox College, Monmouth College, Western Illinois University, and the University of Illinois.
There's so much pressure right now to be the best at what we're doing, to wear the right things, to speak correctly, and not to say the wrong thing, especially in group settings. And we go on so many college visits. I think 4 or 5 different universities we visit regularly. And every single university we've been to, the kids say the same thing, and that's that the dogs don't judge them.
Pagel says therapy dogs are different than service dogs. The latter are trained to be highly obedient and handler-focused. But they want therapy dogs to wag their tails. They want them wiggling their bodies and being excited to approach people and engage with them. She says they don't need to be perfect dogs.
Sit. Sit.
But any dog that's at least a year old is friendly and doesn't get nervous in new situations could be a perfect therapy dog. For more information, you can visit therapydogs.com or the Galesburg Therapy Dogs Facebook page. I'm Jane Carlson.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for joining us. And be with us again next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.